Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Sister Janet Ferns. The Week of Prayer for Christian Unity has been an important focus of the week for the Holy Father and for the whole Church. In today's program, Joan Lewis and I look back at the events of the past few days. Jesus spoke in the synagogue and was rejected as he declared, "A prophet is not accepted in his own country." Jill Bevilacqua and Sean Patrick Lovett reflect on the Gospel for this Sunday.
Jesus began speaking in the synagogue. "Today, this scripture passage is fulfilled in your hearing." All who were present spoke favorably of him. They marveled at the appealing discourse which came from his lips. They also asked, "Is not this Joseph's son?" He said to them, "You will doubtless quote me the proverb, 'Physician, heal yourself,' and say, 'Do here in your own country the things we have heard you have done in Capernaum.' But in fact," he went on, "no prophet gains acceptance in his native place. Indeed, let me remind you, there were many widows in Israel in the days of Elijah, when the heavens remained closed for 3.5 years, and a great famine spread over the land. It was to none of these that Elijah was sent, but to a widow of Zarephath near Sidon. Recall, too, the many lepers in Israel at the time of Elisha the prophet, yet not one was cured except Naaman the Syrian." At these words, the whole audience in the synagogue was filled with indignation. They rose up and expelled him from the town, leading him to the brow of the hill on which it was built, and intending to hurl him over the edge. But he went straight through their midst and walked away.
The scene is the same as last week, and we pick up exactly where we left off. Jesus has read from the book of Isaiah, returned the scroll to the assistant, and sat down. And with all eyes fixed on him, he begins to speak. What were his listeners expecting to hear? Certainly not a declaration that the words of Isaiah they had just heard were being fulfilled in their hearing. "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, therefore he has anointed me." The Anointed One, the Messiah, he who would deliver Israel from her enemies and reign forever in peace. How many in that Sabbath congregation believed that this young man who had grown up among them, son of the local carpenter, could have anything to do with the prophecy of the great Isaiah? He had not been to university. And yet there had been reports, rumours, stories of miracles, healings, cures of lepers, demoniacs. Maybe he'll do something here. But let's listen, see what he has to say. The atmosphere must have been electric. The sceptics, the curious, the cautious, the credulous. All the different sorts of people to be found in an assembly of this kind, they were all there. And all speak favourably of him. All marvel at his appealing discourse, gracious words. And yet, is not this Joseph's son? We're not given different reactions by different categories of people. The simple peasant and the educated rabbi, the local artisans and small shopkeepers, the women in their separate area, they're all equally affected. It's intriguing to try and imagine the scene in the synagogue that day, to wonder whether the word had gone round that Jesus was in the vicinity, so that not only the regular worshippers would be present, but any amount of casual and curious strangers, hoping perhaps to see some prodigious event. But they would have been disappointed, for Mark tells us that he could work no miracle there. Let's hear what the scholars say about synagogue worship.
In every village of any importance, the religious life of the Jews was centred in the synagogue, which was normally a rectangular building with a cupboard in which were kept the scrolls of the Bible and a pulpit from which they were read and expounded to the faithful. The reading and the common prayers were supervised by the ruler of the synagogue. The sermon might be given by a member of the congregation.
Piero Bargellini, in his story of the Gospels, adds that the reading given by the ruler of the synagogue was given first in Hebrew and then in Aramaic, and was different for every day of the year. A comment and explanation of the text followed. Sometimes another qualified person would be invited to speak, or even a visitor. The Manual on Daily Life in Bible Times, however, writes that only certain persons were permitted to lead in worship. Probably there was a certain amount of flexibility on this point, depending on the religious leaders of the place. And if the ruler of the Nazareth synagogue was a local man, as he surely was, perhaps he had even taught Jesus in the synagogue school. He would have been the first to want to know what this local boy made good was teaching. And what of Nazareth? Today's guidebook tells us that it is the largest Arab town in Galilee, providing administrative and commercial services for the surrounding villages. A recent encyclopedia describes it as the capital town of the northern district of North Israel, with a population, mainly Christian, of approximately 70,000. Half a century ago, the population recorded was some 15,500. What was it in the time of our Lord? That of a small, obscure village.
The road sweeps across the broad green plain and climbs into the mountains on which Nazareth is enthroned. At the top of the hill, the road straightens out and runs towards the snow-white houses of Nazareth, towards the thousands of spear-like cypresses, the terraces of fig and olive trees.
The broad green plain referred to here is the plain of Esdraelon, through which ran the main route between Egypt and Syria. In the New Jerome Bible Handbook, the writer, travelling north to Galilee, informs us.
When we cross the plain of Esdraelon, we come to an area which figures surprisingly little in Old Testament history, but which for Christians was to crown the expectations of that history. For on the north side of Esdraelon rise the hills of Galilee, and just 3 miles into these hills stands Nazareth, the home of Jesus.
Nazareth is situated in Lower or South Galilee, and our handbook adds an interesting geographical note.
The terrain of South Galilee is marked by a series of basins watered by drainage from the surrounding hills. The floors of the basins are fertile alluvium and lend themselves to farming, while the towns climb the adjacent hillsides. This was the region described so vividly in Jesus' parables. Fields separated by hedgerows and stone fences, flocks pastured on the hills, towns set on mountaintops, etc. Two towns of South Galilee mentioned in the New Testament, Nazareth and Cana, are built on the sides of rich basins.
And one final note of interest with regard to Nazareth is recorded in this handbook, in a section on the Great Rift Valley of the Jordan.
It is not certain that any of the Palestinian mountains was ever volcanic, although earthquakes are well attested in antiquity and have also occurred in modern times, Nazareth, for example, in the year 1900.
And so we return to the Nazareth of our Lord's time, which still exists, as the guidebook tells.
The ancient centre of Nazareth, where the market and main churches are located, is still notable for its small old houses and winding alleys. From here, the town expanded in all directions, and above the old town is the new Jewish town of Upper Nazareth.
Jewish because the old town is now divided into a Catholic, a Greek Orthodox, and a Muslim quarter, plus 6 mixed quarters. And where was the synagogue of today's gospel? A 6th-century tradition locates it at a spot not far from the Church of the Annunciation, and where today stands a Greek Catholic church. But there seems to be no more evidence than that. After the initial amazement and admiration at the eloquence of their fellow townsmen, the mood of the Nazareth congregation changes abruptly, as Jesus, apparently sensing some kind of opposition or hostility, anticipates the reaction, quoting a well-known proverb, and referring to the wonders he has worked elsewhere. The evangelists are not always strictly chronological, we know, and it's been suggested that possibly this part of Luke's report refers to the second visit and discourse of Jesus in the Nazareth synagogue, which both Matthew and Mark describe as happening later, after he had raised the daughter of Jairus to life in Capernaum. "You will doubtless quote me the proverb, 'Physician, heal yourself,' and say, 'Do here in your own country the things we have heard you have done in Capernaum.'" One can almost hear the murmur of assent to this. "Yes, we have heard, and Capernaum is only 20 miles away. Why should their people be privileged? Surely charity begins at home." But Jesus seems to ignore the murmurs and goes on. "But in fact no prophet gains acceptance in his native place." And in both Matthew's and Mark's accounts we read, "They would not accept him." And so, he could work no miracle there, though he cured a few sick people by laying his hands on them. He was amazed at their lack of faith. Thus Mark. And Matthew concurs. And then comes the climax, the spark that sets the whole synagogue aflame. And it's as if we were suddenly transported to Holy Week, when the crowds acclaim Jesus as he enters Jerusalem on Palm Sunday, and only a few days later are clamouring for his blood. We're given very little of what he actually said that day. We don't have a record of the first part of his discourse, the gracious words which had them marvelling. And what we do have seems almost provocative, as if he wanted them to react. Matthew and Mark seem to suggest a resentment of his hearers, an envy that one of their own townsmen should have such gifts. Writes Matthew,
"He taught the people in their synagogue in such a way that they were astonished and said, 'Where did the man get this wisdom and these miraculous powers? This is the carpenter's son, surely. Is not his mother the woman called Mary, and his brothers James and Joseph, and Simon and Jude? His sisters too, are they not all here with us? So where did the man get it all?' And they would not accept him."
The brothers and sisters we know were probably cousins, as the Hebrew and Aramaic languages do not have separate terms for the various degrees of family relationship. But we may wonder who of these relations was present. We're not told. Mark writes that his disciples accompanied him. But as neither he nor Matthew record the incident in today's gospel, or what provoked it, perhaps it was a different occasion. And yet, all three evangelists record the amazement at the eloquence of the carpenter's son. The old version in Matthew and Mark has them scandalized. But to our gospel. Luke introduces two personalities from the Old Testament, both prophets. Jesus has just given his hearers to understand that he is a prophet, by the reference to a prophet not being accepted in his own country. And already there must have been a movement of irritation, a shaking of heads. And then,
"Indeed, let me remind you, there were many widows in Israel in the days of Elijah, when the heavens remained closed for 3.5 years and a great famine spread over the land."
Widows are mentioned often in the Gospels, and not far from Nazareth, some 8 miles to the south, was Nain, where Jesus had raised to life the son of a widow of that place. And his own mother, too, was now a widow. Nain, we read in the New Jerome Bible Handbook, is a town on the north slope of the hill of Moreh in the plain of Esdraelon. And in a note on the sites of the life of Jesus, Nain, unlike many sites which have rival claimants, is apparently an uncontested little hamlet, where a few tombs have been traced back to New Testament times. The guidebook calls Nain a small Arab village north of Mount Moreh, where, according to tradition, Jesus performed one of his well-known miracles, the reviving of the son of the widow. And after quoting Luke's account, there follows this intriguing comment.
"Despite its holiness, Nain was not frequented by pilgrims, perhaps because, as a French monk who visited the place in 1664 relates, in the village are 100 Arab families, wild as leopards, and therefore only few Christians come here, and there is no sign of the house of the widow. Only as late as 1880 did the Franciscans build a church in the village in honor of the miracle."
In the two intervening centuries, the wild villagers of Nain have doubtless been tamed, or if not, the Franciscans, in the tradition of their founder, have done the job. From the widow of Nain to the widows in the time of Elijah, a name that would have sent a ripple of some trepidation through the listeners in the synagogue, remembering. And H.V. Morton, as he came up the hill that runs into Nazareth, stopped a while to look back over the great plain of Esdraelon to the distant hills of Samaria, remembering.
The brown hills to the south, the hills of Samaria, had known the denunciatory figure of Elijah. They had heard his burning words and seen the prophetic fire in his eyes. On the skyline was the hill that held Naboth's vineyard, and the hill on which Jezebel met death. To the right, the long, calm ridge of Carmel cut the sky, and I looked at it remembering the priests of Baal and the fire that Elijah drew down from heaven to confound them.
Jesus doesn't remind them of these dramatic events, of the prophet of daunting aspect and fearful circumstance, but of the man God in his compassion sent in a time of famine to a widow of Zarephath near Sidon, a town, we read, with a busy harbour, known in Phoenician times for its ceramic industry. This Gentile widow had only a handful of meal in a jar and a little oil in a jug. But Elijah told her to make him a scone to eat and some for herself and her son, and he prophesied.
Jar of meal shall not be spent, jug of oil shall not be emptied, before the day when Yahweh sends rain on the face of the earth.
The prophecy comes true. And as Jesus reminded his listeners, there was another occasion when a Gentile was chosen in preference to a Jew, a leper. Many were the lepers in Israel at the time of Elisha, yet not one was cured except Naaman the Syrian. This is the last straw. The chosen people have been insulted. And as there seemed to be no defenders of the new prophet with his revolutionary words, it's hardly likely that his disciples could have been present. For the whole audience rises up, and a lynching is inevitable. Or is it? For his time is not yet come. And as the furious mob reaches the brow of the hill, ready to hurl their victim over the edge, he goes through the crowd and disappears from sight. And Nazareth, too, disappears from the Gospels.
From the Gospel, we move on to look at the way in which the Week of Prayer for Christian Unity has tried to put its message into practice as Joan Lewis and I look back at the events of the past few days. Joan, welcome back for another programme.
And we look at the highlight of the last 7 days, actually, which has been the Week of Prayer for Christian Unity, during which the Holy Father three times, twice at the weekly audience and once at the Sunday Angelus, spoke of the Week of Prayer for Christian Unity. And in particular, at the Wednesday audience, the talk was indeed, of course, on the Week of Prayer for Christian Unity. And the Holy Father stressed really the word prayer. It is our duty. It's not just the hierarchy, the VIPs of the various churches who have to get together and meet and pray. It's all of us who have to pray for
and
that.
And this is something that was picked up during the week. I interviewed the abbot of St. Paul's Basilica, Dom Edmund Power. And he was saying that one of the things that has struck him during this week of prayer and listening to what the Holy Father has been saying is that the Holy Father has been saying again and again and again, listen. And he was saying that it meant so much to him as a Benedictine because the rule of St. Benedict begins with the word listen.
Well, that's what the Holy Father stressed at the general audience this week. And he said that over these past 40 years of progress on the ecumenical front, he said, what we have learned from the Lord is how to listen, not just to hear.
And one of the features about the Pope going to St. Paul's for the closing of the Week of Prayer for Christian Unity, because as we're recording this, it's actually a few hours before he goes, the place where his chair is situated is immediately before the high altar and the newly opened up
tomb. Right.
And if you look down, now he's going to have his back to it, but I'm sure he'll want to see himself. It's now, where there was the step, it's now covered with thick plate glass.
Right.
So you can see the foundations of the basilica that was built in the year 320. And then you can see part of the wall of the basilica that was built in 390. And you can also see the side of St. Paul's sarcophagus and part of St. Paul's basilica's program of prayer for Christian unity has involved inviting people from other denominations, and the Romanian Orthodox parish from Ostia had vespers there, and the grill in the side of the altar was opened so that people could go and venerate the tomb of St. Paul itself.
A big week for the Holy Father, and he mentioned the highlights of the past year. He mentioned the progress made over 40 years in ecumenism, and then he spoke of his highlights of the last year.
And he spoke very warmly about his recent visit to Turkey and
The Patriarch,
meeting the Patriarch.
Right. Well, as a matter of fact, he sent greetings again during the Wednesday audience. He spoke of that trip, and he said, and I again send greetings to His Holiness Patriarch Bartholomew. And as a matter of fact, one of the other guests of the Holy Father's Week, it was really a week jam-packed with people. I mean, bishops on their Limina visit, and three new ambassadors, one from Turkey, one from Romania, and the first ambassador from Montenegro to the Holy See. What I found very interesting about Montenegro, I was doing a little research, you know, on the country and so forth. It just declared its independence from Serbia last June, so it's a very recent event. But it's a country of only 630,000 people. I don't know, unless it might be San Marino or something like that, I don't know how many other countries we have diplomatic relations with that have a populace that small. But one of the ambassadors, which I just mentioned, of course, was Turkey. And the Holy Father expressed his delight at meeting the ambassador, his profound gratitude to the government and the people for his very warm, wonderful reception in the last days of November. And he did not forget to mention to the new ambassador, he said that he hoped that the Catholic Church would be able to enjoy a juridical status in a recognized juridical statute, and to see the beginning of a fruitful relationship with, of course, the state authorities. So that was mentioned, as well as the highlights of his ecumenical trip. But, you know, there were so many events this week. We could do two of these shows, or we could do four shows, and each one concentrating on a major event. So we have the ambassadors, we have Christian Unity, and then, of course, China. There was a meeting last weekend in the Vatican, a high-level meeting on the question of a look at the Catholic Church in China. And you had Cardinal Zen of Hong Kong. He had just turned 75, and he hopes very much that the Holy Father will accept his resignation so he can dedicate himself to furthering the relations, to get to the point of diplomatic relations between China and the Holy
See. Well, he's worked extremely hard, hasn't he?
He really, really has. And he was joined by another cardinal, Cardinal Shan, who's the Archbishop Emeritus of Kaohsiung in Taiwan, where, of course, they have religious freedom. The Catholic Church is flourishing in certain parts of Taiwan. It's a small number of Catholics, but boy, are they active and dedicated, and there's hundreds and hundreds of religious. There are 80 to 90 orders of religious women, and there are, I think it's either 30 or 40 orders of men. They're waiting to go to mainland China. It's a very interesting thing.
My own congregation had a community there In Taiwan, actually in Taipei for a good number of years.
The church would very much like to have diplomatic relations with China. There's just a few obstacles in the way, and obviously one of the biggest is religious freedom. The Chinese allow, if you will, this patriotic Catholic association, but you do as we say and forget being loyal to the Pope, and they name the bishops and so forth. Of course, the three bishops they ordained this year, those were all illegitimate. They did not have a papal mandate. So there is that question to resolve. And for China, for diplomatic relations to take place, they want the Holy See to break relations with Taiwan, which the Holy See would do, to have everybody to have relations with mainland China, of which Taiwan, I guess, I don't know, would be a part. But it's very, oh, and another thing that China has asked of the Holy See is we don't want interference in our internal affairs. Well, the Vatican, the Holy See, the Church doesn't want to interfere in anybody's affairs. And I think what China sees as interference is if an organization, institution like the Catholic Church speaks out on human right, human life, human dignity, they see that as interference. They see the Holy See as delivering a message to them. Holy See is delivering a message to the world, and China is one of the recipients. But the interesting thing about the China meeting was the several things that were said in the communique that came out afterwards. One was the inspiring witness of the bishops, priests, and lay faithful that was recognized with profound appreciation because those who have never compromised their loyalty to the See of Peter, sometimes at the cost of grave suffering. And we know the people that have been imprisoned and so forth for their faith. And then the note also mentioned with particular joy that today almost all of the bishops and priests are in communion with the Supreme Pontiff. And then a phrase I found interesting because they didn't go into it anymore. The participants spoke of the, quote, surprising numerical growth of the ecclesial community. They didn't mention numbers, and we don't really have numbers. There's been no official survey or any census, if you will, of the church there. And the numbers range quite a bit. Cardinal Shan, who is from mainland China, told me in an interview that he figured it could be anywhere from 10 to 14 or 15 million of your Catholics loyal to the See of Peter and the Pope. I see by our trusty clock that we're getting very low, almost down to no seconds left in our show. So I just want to mention only to everyone listening to us to go to the Holy See's website, the press officer, maybe the Pope himself, and look at his speeches and messages. The Pope's message for 2007 World Communications Day came out on the 24th of January. It's entitled Children in the Media, A Challenge for Education, and it is fantastic. Very readable. It is 1,000 words, and it invites us to reflect, as the Pope says, on two related topics of immense importance. The formation of children is one. The other, perhaps less obvious, but no less important, is the formation of the media. It is a phenomenal message. Some members of the media may be happy, others may not. But I say, if you are a child, if you are a parent, if you are a member of the media, read this message. I wish we had more time today to go into it.
And on that note, God bless.
We'll see you next week.
You have been listening to me, Sister Janet Ferns, and to Joan Lewis, Jill Bevilacqua, and Sean Patrick Lovett. You can hear us all again at the same time next week, or at your leisure, by going to the internet and clicking on English at vaticanradio.org. Until we meet again, may God bless you.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.